It's a beautiful morning, but I'll just get right to it. I have to tell you, I'm troubled this morning. It's been a very difficult week. It's been a difficult week for many of us, I think. We've had more events here in the cities. We've had another killing and a trial and a great deal of tension that I feel that I simply must and my heart goes out to everyone who has had a difficult week. And I hope you're not feeling alone. I hope you'll find solace being together with this group. And my heart goes out to everyone who's been affected by these events, everyone here in the Twin Cities area, and everyone beyond. And I have hope for healing on a deep level. I really do. And I'm going to address these events a little bit, but it's going to take me a while to get there because I want to put this in the context of Zen practice. So here goes. There are many things in this world that we can't control. And our lack of control over things is a source of great suffering because we want to control things. And when we find control slipping away from us, often our response, our first response, is denial, to deny the truth of the situation, and then to try harder to control what is uncontrollable. But what Buddhism teaches us is that there is something that we can control, and that is our response to the uncontrollable. When we control our response, it provides relief from suffering. We realize that we can control just as much as we can control and nothing more, and also nothing less. And finding that balance, well, that's the thing. If we can end the denial, then we can see more clearly, and this helps us to sort out what is controllable and what isn't. So we can focus our efforts on things that can be changed and not waste our time and energy trying to change what can't be changed. There are many different ways that the Buddha taught this lesson. One is the teaching of the eight worldly winds, which I'm going to talk about this morning. They are also known as the eight worldly concerns or the eight vicissitudes. And this teaching is found in the Lokavipada Sutta. I'm using Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation here. It says, "These eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. Which eight? Gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. These are the eight worldly conditions that spin after the world, and the world spins after these worldly conditions." And usually these eight are paired up into four pairs to show that we're kind of at the mercy of these opposite conditions. We seem to get hung up on gain and loss, personal status and disgrace, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. And I'm not going to go into detail about these four pairs. That might be for another talk. Instead, I'm going to say that I find the term worldly winds helpful because the idea is that these things buffet us around. They blow us around. We're at the mercy of stuff that our minds grasp onto. And this stuff is connected with the spinning of the world. It's a little like at the center of the wheel of life, if you're familiar with that, you have the pig, rooster, and the snake, greed, anger, and self-delusion. And that's what keeps the whole wheel turning around. So these worldly concerns, they keep things turning, and we're at their mercy if we don't figure out what's going on. We get buffeted around because of our clinging and our aversion. We want to keep what's good and get rid of what's bad. And this leads to a skewed view of reality. We tend to think the world is organized around us and our plans to get what's good, and we think that we can control how all of this operates, but we can't. So how are things like pleasure and pain wins? How do they blow us around? Well, we get attached to pleasure, we want to preserve it, and we are averse to pain, and we want to push it away. We want to command the wind to only blow in one direction, the direction of pleasure only. And this is actually exhausting. To live in a world where we expect pleasure all of the time requires mountains of denial and rationalization and futile effort. And it may be this exhaustion that brings us to Zen practice. The actual nature of these worldly winds is that they will likely move you one way today and the other way tomorrow. They may move you in the same way for a while. Maybe they move you in the good direction for 3 days in a row, and then you may think you've detected a pattern, or you may even think that now finally you have it all figured out and the winds are going to continue now to move always in the same way. Finally, I've arrived. And then if maybe on the fourth day, the wind seems to be shifting a little bit, and then you respond, and I respond because I'm subject to this too, of course, by denying that there's a shift. You might say, this is momentary. I know the real trend here, and it's just going to favor me. Or you may make futile plans or engage in fantasies. You say, perhaps I could change the direction of the wind. Maybe I'll get the world's largest fan. Or maybe I'll build a building and I'll put a bunch of fans in there. And I'll have my own controlled place separate from the rest of the world. I won't be subject to vicissitudes. I'll control my own environment. Or maybe you take it personally and you become filled with regret. You say, I can't believe the winds did this to me again. This is so unfair. Or maybe worst of all, you might despair. I give up. I'm just not going to try anything ever. So our reaction to pleasure and pain can be like this. And it's the same with status or disgrace, or with praise and blame. Same with gain and loss. It's going to change, but we try to hang on to it. We can't control the fact that it's going to change, but as I said, we can control our response to it. And we do this by accepting the reality of reality. And this is the heart of the Buddha's teaching, as expressed in the Four Noble Truths. Suffering is caused by desire, including the desire to be moved only by the good winds. It's possible to diminish our suffering by diminishing that desire. Through seeing what's going on, that's right view and right thought, we cultivate habits to help us with clear seeing. And that's mindfulness, speech, effort, concentration, and livelihood. And then we can do the right thing. And that's right action. You may notice, I just noticed this morning when I was putting some finishing touches on this talk, that I've reordered the Eightfold Path here to reflect my perspective, which is that action is the outcome. So controlling our response means coming up with a new response, and that begins with seeing what we've done before, what our habitual response has been. Seeing what it is that we ordinarily do when a bad wind is blowing. We can quiet our minds through meditation, and then we watch our mind and see how it works. And we begin to see our patterns of denial, fantasy, futile action, regret. And we may get to the point where we see those things the moment they arise. Wow, there's that again. And we kind of see their relentless and compulsive nature as well. And then when we see these things, we can see that we have a choice. We don't have to go into denial or resistance. Instead, we can say, I think that the bad wind is coming in. I won't deny it. I'll let it come. I'll just see what it is. Maybe it's not a bad wind at all. I will see my life as an adventure heading into reality, facing into the wind, rather than seeking comfort, getting out of the wind. So we have a choice. One article I read on the four winds preparing for this talk said, we have a choice to neither be swept up nor turn our backs on what is happening. As I've told some of you, I think, one-on-one, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this in a Dharma talk, but I have a kind of a personal slogan that I rely on when I don't know what to do. I never intended to have a slogan, and I'm not sure where it came from. I think I made it up myself, but I may have heard it somewhere. And it is simply, take the self out of it. That's what I turn to when I have a tough decision, and it's almost always helpful. And it means seeing the situation without any of my usual habitual patterns, without my desire to be present only with the good winds. And it usually tells me what to do. But to take the self out of it, I have to first see how the self is in it. I have to see my own habitual patterns. And this happens through observation again and again. Oh, there's that again. I did that again. So when we see these winds for what they are, and when we see our habitual responses, then we know which of our responses are helpful and which ones are not. As another article said, we see the delusion of control and we renounce the delusion of control. And then, sometimes at least, we know what to do. We know what's effective and what action to take. Maybe not always. We still may get it wrong. We still may need to make a decision when it really could go either way. We may still have to make a decision that will disappoint someone, but at least we're not taking an action based on some fantasy that the winds should move in our direction every time. We see all of the winds and we accept them all. And this kind of exercise of choice can be a long, long road. And it may proceed smoothly. There may be some bumps. There may be some big insights. But usually there is no big moment where everything changes. Usually there is steady application and steady practice where we see these habitual patterns again and again. And we don't turn away. That's the secret, to not turn away when you see them. And we just do the work with steady effort and a little bit of faith that this is worth doing. So this topic of the four worldly winds came to me this week just because I felt like I'd been blown over. You know, I was asking myself over and over, how our practice can help us with these kinds of difficulties and how our practice can help the world during this kind of very difficult time. And of course, we've all heard the news about the shooting of Dante Wright by a police officer during a traffic stop. And we all know that this happened during the trial of Derek Chauvin, who's charged with murdering George Floyd. And we know that we may have a verdict this week, and things are pretty tense. It's really hard. It's strange to think about what the words Minneapolis and Minnesota mean around the world right now. We get the New York Times on Sunday, and this is the Sunday Review, which is their editorial section on Sunday. And I don't know if you're seeing this forwards or backwards. It looks backwards to me. Forwards, apparently. But it says Minnesota, America. Minnesota, America. And that's on the front page of the review section. And if you open it up, there are three articles here. For one starts, for whom is our state livable? Minneapolis. Minnesota is one of the best places to live in America. It has good schools, excellent housing, and low unemployment. It regularly appears near the top of indexes for livability. But all of that matters much less if you're Black. Across a whole host of measures, unemployment rates, wages, incarceration rates, test scores, home ownership rates, the gaps between white Minnesotans and Black Minnesotans are among the widest in the country. So while Minnesota is a great place to live for white people, for Black people, it's just like everywhere else and sometimes worse. And this writer, this is an opinion piece, says the continued existence of this paradox is driven by buried racism. Unlike places where racism was and is open and transparent, racism in Minnesota is obscured by progressive policy. Our history and legacy of egalitarianism make it harder for us to see racial disparities as manifestations of racism. And then there are two other articles, also both with the Dateline Minneapolis. One is called Protecting Structures, Not People, and the other is called We Sweep Uncomfortable Issues Under the Rug. So this is what we're known for now, apparently, at least in some circles. And this is, I think, our biggest problem. So yeah, the winds seemed to shift so suddenly this week. For me, and I thought this might be true of others as well. For some who are closer to it, like for instance, the people who wrote these articles, it's just the same old wind. There's probably no shift at all. But still, perhaps this teaching can be helpful here. My initial plan was to talk about all the reasons I've been feeling optimistic lately, because there are a lot. You know, spring is here, and it feels really good to be outside after that long winter of isolation. And work on our new Zendo is proceeding. And if you drive by, you can see the Zendo going up. Regarding COVID, signals are mixed, but more and more people are getting vaccinated and things are starting to open up. And we really can start to think about the time when we'll be practicing together in person before too long, if we're local. But that wind shifted dramatically, and I was reminded once again of these deep currents in our society that can't be ignored. And my own concerns started to seem really small. And the situation is painful for everyone. I, as a white person, can't even imagine what it's like for people of color, for Dante Wright's family, for his community. I can't imagine the suffering of the police officer And you know that we have to include her in this as well. So it seems like, you know, maybe we start to stand up and we get blown over again. And the Buddha identified these four pairs of winds, but we could come up with more. We could add one perhaps about current events. I would define current events as events affecting large numbers of people, which are perceived as either positive or negative. And we could call this pair good news and bad news, and we could apply this to it. We're blown around by this good news, bad news pair. We really want the news to be good, and it seems like we just really need that right now. The St. Paul paper publishes graphs and maps about COVID case rates, as many papers do, and I watch those graphs every day, and it seems sometimes like my well-being is being graphed right there on that same graph. I really need these things. And a big event can lead to the usual denial, as in, it's just not true, it's just not happening the way they say it is, it's a media creation, there is no pandemic, there is no pattern of racial injustice here. It can lead to fantasy, the problem is just going to go away, you'll see. It can lead to despair, inaction, or futility, just giving up, or giving up on others and wanting to be like a survivalist, just find your own place, no longer interact with anyone else. And it can lead to an oversimplified view of the world, which we can adopt in order to cope. There can be a kind of willful refusal to see interconnections. This means maybe that we pick out one cause of a complicated situation, and we focus all of our attention on that to the exclusion of everything else. It's those people there who are the problem, and all I have to do is oppose those people, and the matter is closed, and I will fend off any challenges to my beliefs. So those are just some of the habitual responses I've come up with, and you may think I'm talking about other people and how messed up they are, but I am prone to these myself. They pop into my head all the time, and sometimes they stay a while. But our practice is to watch our tendency to do that, to be brutally honest about it, to see reality, both the reality of the world and our reactions to it. And we have to see both of those things. But I think it starts with our reactions. So as I said, we see primarily through meditation practice how these habitual responses arise through being present with our own mind, through courage and effort. There it is again. I'm escaping into fantasy again. What is it that I don't want to face? What is it that I don't want to feel? And we come back to the reality of our reactions again and again, and we see that we have that choice. We don't have to escape. We can stay with the thing we don't want to stay with, and we can begin to see the reality of our world as it really is, without our preferences obscuring our vision. We see and feel all of the winds. We see the complexities of the situation, whatever it is, COVID, race relations, whatever it is, ignoring no part of it, facing our own role in it, however we perceive that to be, and then possibly knowing what action to take and having the strength to do it. So again, action is the outcome, and that may seem pretty audacious, reordering the Eightfold Path to put action at the end. Of course, it isn't really so much, because the Eightfold Path has been ordered in multiple ways, and they are all true, and it's a matter of perspective. You could put any of them at the beginning and any at the end. I acknowledge all of these ways of ordering them, and I accept them all, but this is the perspective that I choose to emphasize. This is where I'm coming from as a teacher. There are many ways to teach the Dharma, and there are many teachers at MZMC. I may be guiding teacher, but that doesn't mean that my interpretation of the Dharma is assumed to be correct or presented as being correct. If we start saying there's one correct view, we're really in trouble. So I'm offering one view for your consideration, and it's my personal view. And sometimes Buddhist teachings are criticized as supporting or leading to an outcome of personal bliss and well-being, which sounds pretty good, but it's a criticism of it that it's a kind of detachment from the world, like sitting apart from the world on a mountaintop, as opposed to being involved in the market square, as opposed to being involved in compassionate action. It's criticized as being escapist. And I'm not interested in escapism myself, and even not so interested in that quest for personal bliss. If you know me, or if I'm your teacher, you may hear from me, to put it in kind of crass terms, that I want your personal suffering to end as soon as possible for your sake. And once it does, I've got a job for you, and that's saving all beings. Or maybe even we'll start with the latter. We'll start with saving all beings. If we start there, maybe that will be the path toward ending personal suffering. But there is that perceived view that what we're teaching is, hey, you just turn inward and you say, I'm not bothered by the state of the world because I know the world is not real and I have my own personal bliss. And sometimes this is just a misunderstanding of Buddhism, an overemphasis on emptiness and leaving out of form, a misunderstanding that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. One is not better than the other. We're not trying to escape the world of form to get to the world of emptiness or the world of interconnectedness. Also, it can be a matter of emphasis. You need personal well-being in order to do good work in the world. Doing good work in the world can give you personal well-being. They support each other, and ultimately, they're the same thing. And different teachers, and even the same teacher at different times, may choose to come from one perspective or the other. And sometimes the misperception may be a result of poor teaching on our part. We say things like, you must accept things as you are. No, I'm sorry, let me change that. We say things like, you must accept things as they are. You must accept what is. Instead of providing the more nuanced version, which is, accept the truth of how things are. Accept the reality that there are things you can change and things that you can't change, and then change what you can. And sometimes I think teachers really do move a little too close to that view that it's all about personal liberation and that it's about rising above the problems of the world rather than solving them. So I would really not want for my talk to be misunderstood this morning. My theme is that we cannot control everything in our world, but we can control to some extent our response to it. The teaching of the eight winds can help us to see how our responses can be whole and can fit the actual winds that blow us around, as opposed to our fantasy view of what these winds are. And I've applied that just a bit to current events, to good news and bad news. What I'm not saying here is that you can't do anything about injustice or disease or the state of your neighborhood or your family's financial situation or whatever. What I'm not saying is that the solution to our society's problems is to rise above the winds and be okay no matter what happens. That would be escapism. What I am saying here is that we can do something about injustice and disease and the state of our neighborhoods or whatever. What I am saying is that the solution to our society's problems is to see the winds for just what they are and to engage with them and to engage with the good and bad news of the world and make things better. And if you do that, bliss will actually very likely come. So maybe it's all the same. I put action first because I see the suffering. That is my perspective. And I'll finish just by saying that leaves a very big question. How do we make the world better? Exactly what do we do? Well, that I leave up to you. And so that's my talk, and I would be happy to hear from you.